Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the new. Welcome to the Disability Studies channel in the New Books Network. I'm Shu Wan. I'm a founding editor and host of the new channel. I am a disability historian. Currently, I'm a doctoral student in history at the University of Buffalo. Today, I'm very honored to invite two very famous disability historians, Dr. Gerber and Dr. Denenfield, to join our episode to talk about their newest book about the importance of disability rights in American, in post-war American society. So the first thing I want to do is I want to invite both, the two professors to introduce themselves.
My name is Bruce Dierenfield, and I have been teaching modern American history and civil liberties and civil rights for a long time. I myself am significantly hearing impaired and have worn hearing aids all my adult life. Not that that makes everything perfect, because it doesn't. And part of the reason I was attracted to this research project is because I felt I could relate to the principal figure, Jim Zobrist, on many different levels, that being one of them.
So thank you, Professor Dierenfield. So how about Professor Gerber? Could you please?
My name is David Gerber, and I taught for many years at the State University of New York at Buffalo's History Department. I've taught and written on a number of different things, but later in my career as a scholar and researcher, I took an interest in disabled veterans of military conflict from a disability as well as military point of view. And that led gradually into an interest in disability in general. And that brought me to my collaboration with Professor Dierenfield on the social history of the Zobrist lawsuit.
Okay, thank you so much. Here, I want to personally emphasize Professor Gerber, because I'm a disability historian. I'm much more familiar with Professor Gerber's scholarship. I want to say he is one of the most important disability historians in the United States or even in the world. And his earlier research about disabled veterans in American society is so influential, so important. Then let's switch to Professor Gerber and Professor Dierenfield's book, newest book, Disability Rights and Religious Liberty in Education. The subtitle is A Story Behind Zobrist vs. Catania Foothill School District. So let's begin the first question. So as we can see here, this book is about a lawsuit between Zobrist and the school district. So my first question is that, could you please talk a little bit about who is the Zobrist? Jim Zobrist, the main figure in this book.
Let me address the question of Jim Zobrist. Jim Zobrist was born in 1974. And within a year, as a result of his parents' suspicion that he wasn't hearing well, was diagnosed rather casually by a pediatrician as profoundly deaf. Let me talk to you a bit about the Zobrist family. The family that Jim was born into was a kind of typically middle-class family of the mid-20th century United States. Both Sandy, the mother, and Larry, the father, grew up in working class to lower middle class families in industrial cities of the United States. They met in Erie, Pennsylvania, where they were both in college, and they were both students. Larry Zobrist made his way through college by delivering beer, and he delivered beer to a party at which Sandy was enjoying herself. They met and danced, and within a short period of time, got married. Larry made his living as a young married man as a salesman for an office technology company. He'd worked his way through college and has worked hard his entire life. He later owned a dry cleaning shop in Tucson, Arizona. The mother, Sandy, Jim's mother, studied to be a teacher in college in Erie, Pennsylvania. And after having a child, she dropped out of the workforce to be a homemaker for a while, but she re-entered teaching relatively early in parenthood, in part because the family wanted to enhance its material resources. Sandy also went back to school to learn about educating deaf children and to learn American Sign Language. She wanted to enhance her teaching credentials, but she was particularly interested, as she would be for the all of Jim's education and beyond his education, in helping him negotiate his relations with the hearing world. Much of Sandy's energies as a mother were devoted to seeing that Jim got a proper education. And what Professor Derenfield and I came to understand and spend time in our book analyzing the consequences of, was that the proper education for the Zobrists meant an education that would fit Jim into the society of hearing people, not the society of deaf people. At the time in the 1970s, on the crest of education legislation and changes in public opinion and the dawning of the disability rights movement, there was an idea that deaf children can be completely integrated into the society of able-bodied people, and that was the best course for them. The Zobrists spent a lot of time in the next two decades shopping for educational opportunities to make this happen. The first opportunities that they took advantage of were Jim's education in primary school, and I guess in what we would call the equivalent of kindergarten and the early grades at the Barber Center in Erie, Pennsylvania. This was a private facility for disabled children that was started by a woman named Gertrude Barber, who had come to understand in the years after World War II that the large majority of children with disabilities weren't being educated anywhere. And she started this school in Erie, Pennsylvania. But the school only went so far. And when Jim had exhausted the possibilities of being educated in Erie, Pennsylvania at the Barber Center, the Zobrists shopped for opportunities for him. And that eventually led to their relocating in Tucson, Arizona. Jim, meanwhile, just as a so that he doesn't disappear from the narrative of his parents' guidance, came to absorb and eventually, as he got older, fully agree with the course of study and ultimately life that his parents had set him in. Jim never aspired to be part of the deaf community or deaf culture, but rather to find ways to fit into the hearing world.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Professor Gerber. Your introduction of Jim Zobrist's early life and his education and the interesting story about him as a deaf people, but living in a much more hearing society and his encounters with hearing, both hearing and deaf societies. So my next question is that, could you please talk a little bit about, Jim Zobrist's enrollment and experience in the Arizona School of Deaf and Blind? I think that's a very important site and I want to say place in both in his own life and Lee's book.
Well, I wrote about that, and Professor Derenfield and I agreed that I could talk about that, and I'll address it briefly. After Jim had exhausted the resources available to him at the Barber Center, his parents faced a choice as to where he was going to be educated. The reputation of the Erie, Pennsylvania public schools for educating children with disabilities was poor at the time. And in fact, there was an action before the U.S. Civil Rights Office involving the poor education of disabled children in Erie, Pennsylvania. Jim's parents didn't want to send him to a residential school, which would have him away from home. So Sandy Zobrist, in her role as the principal negotiator and explorer of opportunities for Jim, wrote deaf organizations for advice on where it was that Jim might be well educated. One of the places that came up in her explorations was the Arizona School for the Deaf and for the Blind, which was then in a suburb of Tucson, Arizona, but is now within the city boundaries of Tucson. Well, I believe it came to be within the boundaries of Tucson. And without knowing a great deal about the specific philosophy of education of the school, but seeing an opportunity to relocate to a place where if they established residence, Jim would be educated without having to pay for it, because the Arizona school is part of the public school system in Arizona, they decided to move to Tucson, Arizona, or one of its suburbs. They also had relatives there to help them resettle, family. So Jim was enrolled in the Arizona School for the Deaf and the Blind. And they discovered within a short period of time that the Arizona school had a complicated curriculum that fitted children simultaneously to communicate with hearing people, but also prepared them for life as deaf people, learning sign language with facility, and learning the history of deafness and learning about and participating in deaf culture. This did not suit the Zobrist definition of how they wanted Jim to be educated. They had thought it was a public school, like a regular public school, and he would be surrounded by influences from the able-bodied community. But this was not the case, and the teachers did not see that as the goal of the institution. There were other things as well that led them to want to take Jim out of that school. They felt he was smarter than the curriculum enabled him to be educated. So it was at this point that Sandy and Larry Zobrist, and Sandy in particular, because she had gone to the Arizona School for the Deaf and the Blind to make various complaints and to ask various questions about Jim's education. It was at this point that they decided to remove Jim from the Arizona school and put him into a regular public school in the neighborhood in which they lived, which was a suburb of Tucson.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Wasn't there a problem also with discipline in that?
Yes.
School, and they were alarmed by the lack of order that they found there.
That was among the other problems that Sandy reacted to, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Professor Dernfield and Professor Gerber. So, I mean, we learned from your talk is about, okay, James and his family feel frustrated about the education James took in the Arizona school. So my next question is that we know this kind of frustration finally led to the lawsuit Zobrist verdict Catalina Foothill School District. So my next question is about, could you please talk a little bit about the origin of this lawsuit?
Why don't I, we talked a little bit earlier about talking about the Catholic school that Jim Zobrist was in. Maybe this is the time to talk about that a little bit. So as Professor Gerber said, Jim Zobrist went to public school for a few years, and then the time came to look at high school. But the school district, the Catalina Foothills School District, did not have a high school at that time. So in considering their choices, one of the possibilities that the school officials mentioned was, why don't you go to a public school in a surrounding district? And they had no interest in that because they had a rather jaundiced view of what was going on in public education then. And so because they were Catholics and because they felt that a Catholic education was a good moral foundation for their son, they decided to send their son to Sal Point Catholic High School, which was run by the Carmelite order. It didn't hurt that Sal Point had an excellent athletic program, and Jim was very interested in basketball. As far as Jim's life in the high school, there are different accounts. Some say that he was getting along well. He told jokes and he had lots of friends. Those tended to be reports by teachers or administrators who may not have fully appreciated what Jim was experiencing. We know that Jim said himself to the editor of the yearbook that he felt alone much of the time. He felt isolated, that people with full hearing would found it too difficult to talk to him, more than saying, hello, how are you doing, how's it going, something very superficial. It helped that his brother Sam, his younger brother Sam, joined that school fairly soon after Jim started. But I think, as Jim pointed out to us, he was really felt much more comfortable in junior high than in high school. And we can see this in a number of ways. And some of his friends did not continue to that high school, and that contributed to a sense of isolation. He played basketball, wanted to go to play collegiate basketball, but that proved to be difficult too because of the coach's attitude, I think, toward players with disabilities, particularly those with deafness, because they couldn't hear commands that were said immediately or because they didn't adjust quickly enough. Jim did have an interpreter. The interpreter was expensive, sign language interpreter. And he was good, and he was just a little older than Jim, and they got along well. And this interpreter would coach teachers how to make the best possible communication for Jim occur. And of course, it was exhausting for the interpreter. He was on call constantly. Eventually, he developed carpal tunnel syndrome. He needed a break, and it was difficult. And it was difficult for the Zobrists to pay for it. They went bankrupt for several reasons. One of them, Professor Gerber alluded to, with their business in Tucson failing, mainly because of arson. So when we talked to Jim Zobrist, he thought he got a good education and he was a, quote, good student. He graduated with a B average. But he said to us, his happiest day at Sal Point is the day his name was called at graduation to pick up his diploma. So that tells you something about what he experienced there. Of course, the school was religious. There were brothers, the Carmelite order. There were crucifixes. Theology was a required course. Daily Mass. Jim Zobrist didn't go to that, but it suffused the school environment. There were retreats, religious retreats. There was an emphasis on community service. So religion was certainly very much integral to the experience that all students there had. So that's kind of a brief capsule summary of Jim in South Point. As for the lawsuit, the school district, the Catalina Foothill School District, refused to pay for the interpreter that everybody agreed Jim needed. I mean, Jim did speech read. He did have his brother, but his brother wasn't in the same classes. Brother wasn't on the basketball team either. And Jim was not going to be able to succeed in that mainstream experience without an interpreter. Everybody agreed to that. And the question was it required on the part of the public authorities? And the Zobrists believed that it was required by the Education for All Handicapped Children Act of 1975, which required a free and appropriate public education for all children with disabilities. And they also argued that it was their religious freedom under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, that they had a right to send their son to a Catholic school and have the public school district pay for the interpreter. Remember, there's no public high school in the district. So the Zobrists were invited to ship their son off to another school, public school, and they had no interest in that. So, and in some ways, I think the Zobrists felt betrayed by the public school officials, that they had been assured that he would continue to have an interpreter at South Point Catholic School in the same way that he had had in the public junior high. So they heard, the family heard one thing, and the school officials were thinking another thing. In any event, Sandy Zobrist made it plain that she was going to sue unless some action was taken. The interpreter cost about $8,400 a year, which was a large sum for them. So while Sandy Zobrist is talking to the Arizona Center for Law and the Public Interest about representation in federal court, it had to be a federal court. The school officials were checking with their attorney and with the deputy county attorney, and they came to the conclusion, and the attorney general state, that the law, the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, did not require them to pay for this interpreter. So the trajectory of the lawsuit began in Tucson in front of a federal court judge named Richard Bilby. And Richard Bilby was a singularly unsympathetic judge because, as he said, he knew a friend who had a deaf disabled member of his family, and he knew about that, so that was good enough. presumptuous, to say the least. In any event, he bought the school district's line that the First Amendment forbade this kind of public aid in the form of a sign language interpreter for Jim Zobrist. So that's the first of three levels that the court process involved, and Jim Zobrist lost. So that meant it had to go up to the next highest level, which was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for the United States San Francisco. The judges there, after a long period of delay, finally decided that Judge Bilby, the lower court judge, was correct, that the First Amendment did not allow aid to those children in a Catholic school who have disabilities. I should mention that another member of the legal team for the Zobrist was the father of Jim's first teacher in Erie, Pennsylvania, at this Barber Center that Professor Gerber referred to a moment ago. And the father's name was William Bentley Ball, one of the most estimable and accomplished and experienced attorneys involving church and state in the United States. He himself would handle 9 cases before the Supreme Court and assist in 25 others, and won some of them. The case takes a decided turn because Ball's interest was primarily church and state, and in lowering the wall separating church and state. Although his daughter was involved in teaching children who had disabilities, and his son-in-law wasn't deaf and had a prominent position in the deaf community, Attorney Ball's interest was in trying to help Catholic education primarily, and in that, along the way, it would help children with disabilities, but that was a secondary consideration. In any event, after the Ninth Circuit Court rejected the Zobrist petition to have their interpreter paid for, the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when it was there, the issues were basically these two. Was it legal for a government to provide special and ongoing educational assistance in a religious school to someone who had disabilities? And secondly, what was a sign language interpreter really like? Was the interpreter a neutral kind of a machine, a human machine? Or was this person really an educator who could promote religion, who had that effect of promoting religion? The attorney for the school district, John Richardson, argued that the First Amendment did apply and that there was nothing that the school district was obligated to do. For instance, Richardson pointed out to the court that an interpreter in a theology class, for instance, might say Jesus Christ was the Son of God, or that he died to save his sins. And that interpreter, if the Zobrist had their way, would be paid with tax money. So this, from Richardson's point of view, was absolutely unthinkable. Richardson also pointed out the Supreme Court had previously declared illegal the use of state-paid tape recorders. And if William Bentley Ball is going to argue that the interpreter is like a tape recorder, well, the Supreme Court's already said you can't have a state-paid tape recorder. Long story short, the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, wrote the opinion, and he had for years lamented the jurisprudence the court had delivered concerning church and state. And he argued that there was no establishment here, and that to deny this aid would be to discriminate against this Zobrist, and that would be impermissible. So for the first time, the Supreme Court permitted a state-paid employee to be part of a religious school's educational program. And one of the offshoots of this, I haven't mentioned this before, but William Bentley Ball, the Zobrist attorney, was really hoping to use this case as a vehicle to strike down a previous test the Supreme Court had handed down to adjudicate matters like this one, and that's called the Lemon Test. And in the Lemon Test, there's three steps, three parts to it to determine whether a state law is legal. And from Ball's point of view, he wanted that Lemon Test struck down because it seemed to be used as a weapon against state aid for religion or state aid for disability, students with disabilities. In the end, Chief Justice Rehnquist, in a 5-4 majority opinion, wrote that the Lemon Test, he ignored it. He didn't do anything about it. Well, cut my story a little bit short, the Zobrist won that case, and they were paid by the school district. School district had to pay all the attorneys. School district had to pay for the interpreter. And it was an important moment because it was part of what the court had been doing for a few decades, trying to figure out ways in which the state could permissibly aid students or programs in religious schools. Disability was an adjunct to that issue. There had been another case shortly before this overest, about 10 years before. It involved a girl in a New York district, Amy Rowley. And William Rehnquist also handled that case. And in that case, this deaf girl wanted to have an interpreter and wanted the school to pay for it. And William Rehnquist wrote the opinion in that case as well, this earlier case, in which he said the deaf girl did not need the interpreter and she was not entitled under the law to aid that would allow her to develop fully, only adequately, only approximately what other students could get. So the state is not obliged to do more than kind of the minimum, if you will. Well, that's kind of the trajectory of the case. Professor Gerber may want to add a point or two to what I've said.
No, I think that was a wonderful summary of the origins of the lawsuit, the progress of the lawsuit through the courts, and the nature of the Supreme Court's decision. I am prepared to talk about the consequences of the decision for the law. Church-state separationists, I think, were very apprehensive after the 1993 decision in the Zobrist case, that the Zobrist case would be a strong statement in behalf of the tearing down of the wall of separation between church and state that had been guiding many court decisions in the post-World War II decades. They were much more apprehensive about that than they were concerned about how it might be used for the good in helping children with disabilities. That did not happen. The way in which the decision was framed did not make the Zobrist case a significant factor in tearing down the wall of separation. And I'll explain why to some extent in a minute. The Zobrist case was of value in regard to children with disabilities in one context soon after the decision. And that was in 1997 in a significant Supreme Court decision in the case of Augustini versus Felton, which overturned the court's another decision that the court had made in 1985. The issue at stake in the Augustini case in 1997 was a New York City public school program that offered remedial educational opportunities to individual children in religious schools. And a significant number of these children had learning disabilities. These were poor kids who had problems in learning. And some of these problems were organic and psychological problems. The court had ruled earlier that any public resources to help those children enhance their education that could build on the limited resources available to religious schools were a breach of the wall of separation between church and state, and that this was unconstitutional. But using the Zobrist case as a precedent, the court now ruled that public resources that benefited children and not their schools directly, but the benefit of the children, were not unconstitutional. And in the background to the court's decision was the fact that the New York City Board of Education, after the first decision in 1985, had spent enormous amounts of money trying to help these kids and gone to enormous difficulties to create room for public help in doing so. And they were unsuccessful until 1997, when the Zobrist case was used to for the court to overturn its own decision in 19, 85. The court ruled that public school teachers could now instruct these learning disabled children in religious schools if the content of those teachers' teaching was secular, that didn't involve religion, and there was no excessive administrative entanglement between the New York City Board of Education and the Catholic parochial schools and their clerical leadership. In the years since then, because of the way in which these church-state questions have presented themselves in litigation, Zobrist has not served as a precedent in major cases that have radically changed church-state law in education. And the court has been radically changing church-state law in education. For example, significant recent decisions that have shifted the balance in using public resources to make the path into and through religious schools easier. These cases have come from Missouri, New Mexico, and Maine. And they're ones involving resources given directly to the children themselves, and not necessarily children with disabilities or without disabilities, just children in general. And in one case, there involved a grant for physical improvement of school grounds and playgrounds and other tuition assistance for parents. The Zobrist case was to help an individual kid. And the Augustini versus Felden case was to help individual kids who had learning disabilities and were behind in school. These other and newer cases were really posed at the institutional level and helped kids implicitly, but down the line from direct funding. From my own point of view as a church-state separationist, it's quite suitable to see the limited nature of the Zobrist decision, because I think that helping children to become educated and to get an equitable resources in benefiting that effort is a worthwhile thing for us to do. And it doesn't necessarily disturb greatly the boundaries of religion and public life and the state. So Zobrist helped greatly with one situation, which involved a very large number of children. But beyond that, it has been mentioned seldom in the court's deliberate efforts to tear down the boundaries of church and state.
Oh, thank you so much, Professor Derenfield and Professor Gerber. Thanks for your introduction and survey of the arranging of the lawsuit and its final decision and its influence on in American history. So my last question today is about just beyond the history. So I want to invite you, both of you, to talk about the present and the future of disability rights in America over three decades after ADA, the very important legislation.
Well, let me begin by saying that ADA has had a positive effect, but we still are in a position where the large majority of people with disabilities are unemployed. And integrating people with disabilities into the workforce has been a much more complicated, protracted, and frustrating process than ADA is able to facilitate on its own, for reasons that have to do with the structural limitations of ADA as law. We really need to work on the question of the integration of people with disabilities into the workforce, because until the majority of people with disabilities are able to work and support themselves and be productive members of society and be allowed to make a contribution to the general welfare as well as their own, people with disabilities will lag behind the rest of the population. I think we have a long way to go to the extent that most people with disabilities are unemployed.
In the Buffalo area, we are spending lots of money and time to make sure that curbs at street intersections are flush with the road itself or the street itself. Now, that's nice, but that is such a small matter, really. On a more positive note, I had a student this summer who is in a wheelchair, and he was recommended very highly to me by a colleague as a possible research assistant for me. And he came and we had a meeting. I always have a meeting with whoever is thinking of working with me. And I was to have him do a lot of work using a computer and various internet sites and so on. But I think it's a sign of the times, I hope, that I didn't ask him, can you do this job? Let's see you work a computer. I just took him at his word and that he could do it unless he proved otherwise. As I say, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but maybe I wouldn't have had that attitude 10, 20 years ago. So I hope there's something that's causing us to look at people and what they can do and not what they look like.
Okay, thank you so much, Professor Gerber and Professor Durenfield. Thanks so much. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, after several decades of ADA, there are still a lot of things we needed to do and we should do to improve the situation of the people and life and situation of people with disabilities and to promote disability rights in American society. I want to say thank you again for you coming to my episode to talk about your book, which is a very interesting book, and I highly recommend everybody to read this book, Disability Rights and Religious Liberty in Education. That's our episode today. Thank you.